Hi, everybody. Welcome to the latest podcast of The Myers Way. Today, I have Dr. David Brady here with us, and we are going to be talking about one of my absolute favorite topics, autoimmune disease. Dr. Brady has 22 years experience in integrative medicine. He is not only a naturopathic physician, but he is also a chiropractor, which I just realized today, as well as a clinical nutritionist. He serves as the vice provost at the Division of Health Sciences and the interim dean at the College of Naturopathic Medicine and the director of Human Nutrition Institute at the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. So welcome, David, or Dr. Brady. So happy to have you here.
Oh, just David, Amy. Thank you for having me as a guest. It's an honor.
So David just finished up a talk, I'm assuming, about autoimmune disease at the Integrative Health Symposium, which is actually where I first got introduced to functional medicine. I think it was 4 or 5 years ago now. The conference changed my life. And, you know, David and I have become colleagues and friends over the years. And I'm sorry to miss the conference this year, but I'm very happy that you're here on the Myers Way.
Great. Well, glad I can be here.
Awesome. Well, so would you first, you know, I really like to have you introduce yourself in your own way and then also really tell us your story. Many of us who do integrative, alternative, functional medicine have a personal story. I don't know if you actually do have a personal story about how you got into this, but if you do, our listeners always love to hear those and know that they're not in this boat alone.
Well, I do. We probably don't have enough time then for me to really tell it. But as you alluded to, I did my original clinical training, you know, more than 20 years ago now, I hate to say, as a chiropractic physician. And I went to school in Texas. So yay, Texas, right?
Yay, Texas.
In the Houston area. And where I went to chiropractic school, it was very very broad scope, progressive type of program. And I did all of my hospital rotations in the Houston Medical Center with all of the medical students and all of that. And I had a lot of mentors there who were really into clinical nutrition and botanical medicine and, you know, things that we might associate now more with, you know, naturopathic medicine or integrative medicine. So I got exposed to that as well as the physical medicine. And that's what I really gravitated to, sort of finding new, novel ways to deal with, you know, chronic complex internal disorders. So that's where my career kind of brought me into practice, but also into just voraciously attending all kinds of seminars and workshops and certifications. And I found my way into functional medicine at the very beginning. I think I was at the second symposium on functional medicine 20 some years ago. And I just sort of took that wild ride and ended up then going to naturopathic medical school and doing graduate training in nutrition. And then I've had this sort of 20 year career where I've always been in private practice dealing with complex patients from a systems biology or a functional medicine perspective. And I've been in academia pretty much that whole time. Now, as you said, I've been at the University of Bridgeport for about 17 years, and I was faculty, then I was a dean, and then I now oversee the entire division of health sciences, six colleges, 10 programs, a whole public clinic system, residency training. So it's really cool to be able to bring a lot of what I've learned in this model of medicine to a whole new generation of providers and students. And, you know, we like to kind of think we're changing healthcare one graduate at a time by making very collaborative, open-minded, not so open-minded that their brains fall out, but, you know, evidence-based, open-minded, collaborative, integrative practitioners for the future, because people need them. And I originally found my way even into chiropractic and then into naturopathic medicine because of some health challenges in my family. My mother battled breast cancer pretty much the whole time I was growing up. And she eventually found some sort of alternative complementary cancer therapy that was very effective for her. So that opened my mind to the fact that there are actually other opinions and other ways to approach things that you don't always hear when you go to your, you know, standard physician. So anyway, that kind of sent me off on that path. It's a long, winding road from engineering into where I am now, but it's been a great ride. And I met some great people along the way, including you.
Yeah, awesome. And you're so down to earth. I mean, I've always just known you kind of as David, and we get together and have dinner with our little tribe when we're at conferences. And it's really great to hear your story and your background and, you know, just what an impact you have on, you know, creating future physicians. So thanks so much for all of that.
Oh, it's a lot of fun.
So what I know of you is usually lectures on autoimmunity, and I'm kind of curious of how that became one of your favorite topics. I know it's one of mine, but I myself had autoimmunity, but how, is there a reason that you kind of settled, not settled, but that that became an area that you really became an expert in?
Well, it seems to be what I've been lecturing at a lot of the major conferences on in the last several years, along with global pain syndromes or central pain processing, like fibromyalgic type problems and the like. But, you know, it's really spanned the gamut over time. But autoimmunity is something that really has become sort of an issue of passion for me over the last 5 years, I would say, and probably out of sheer desperation, because the amount of it that's walking in our offices is just staggering. I mean, we're experiencing really what amounts to as an epidemic of autoimmune disease in the Western industrialized countries, most pronounced in the United States. So any of us who do the kind of medicine that we do in particular, where people are kind of looking for other answers because they haven't gotten great answers when they went to the normal places, come to us. And a lot of it is autoimmune in nature. And the whole construct of autoimmune disease and why it occurs and how the dominoes fall really lend itself to this functional medicine integrative approach, because it touches so many aspects of our physiology and how we interact with our environment. And we've really created what I'd like to say is sort of a perfect storm in our culture for autoimmune disease. And we'll talk about some of those elements, I'm sure, as we go through our interview today. But it's become a passion of mine, probably out of necessity, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I now, as the more that I see, and I think, you know, I'm writing a book on autoimmunity, and so, you know, now I'm attracting even more people with autoimmunity, and it's really incredible. And the number of people walking around that actually have antibodies and haven't really been diagnosed yet. It's just skyrocketing the numbers.
What's even worse is they have antibodies and they're told by their physician, no, that's normal. ANA in a female, no, that's normal. A lot of people have that. Well, a lot of people have it, right. But it's not normal to attack your own tissue.
Right, exactly. You know? And we'll talk about that, just kind of why, you know, it does take people so long to get diagnosed. I mean, I have people coming into my office. I think in my research for the book, it's something like an average of 6 to 10 physicians that people see before actually getting diagnosed with an autoimmune disease.
Right, yeah. I agree.
So you published a great paper, which is really, it's just an incredible paper. And I'm not saying that because you're on the talk with me here. It really is a really great breakdown of a lot of what we as functional medicine and integrative medicine practitioners believe are the causes to autoimmune. So it's called Molecular Mimicry, Hygiene Hypothesis, Stealth Infections, and Other Examples of Disconnect Between Medical Research and the Practice of Clinical Medicine, Autoimmune Disease. And I'm assuming, people, that was in the Open Journal of Rheumatology and Autoimmune Disease. We'll put a link in the podcast, everybody, in the actual blog to the paper. But is that something people can actually, do they have to have access to a medical journal, or can they just get this offline?
No, it's open access at the journal site, but also at my website, drdavidbrady.com, just drdavidbrady.com. In the articles tab, you'll find several papers on autoimmunity. One of them is that paper. Another was published in the Townsend Letter. I think another one was in Naturopathic Doctor News and Review, and they're all made freely available. And that title, I understand, is absolutely ridiculously long, but I was trying to make a point in it, and we'll talk about all those different elements hopefully today.
Absolutely. So that's great to know. I'll be going to your website after this. Everybody, check out David's website for this information. So let's talk about, you know, let's just kind of start getting into the paper. And what are, you know, you said that, and in my research, I believe autoimmune diseases have quadrupled in the last 50 years. What are some of the reasons for that?
Well, it's complex between how we interact with our environment, what we've done to manipulate our immune response, and a lot of changes that are going on in the way we actually live. I think probably the place to start with autoimmunity is it's pretty clear that when you think of autoimmune disease, you should think of this disease sort of sitting on a stool, and the stool is three legs. You have to have all three legs there for the disease to stand, okay? And one of it, one of the legs is you need to have some exposure to what we call an antigen, and it's usually a protein that we're being exposed to in our environment. And it could be a protein in our food. In the case of celiac disease, for instance, it's gluten or gliadin in grains and things like that. But it could be a protein that's associated with a virus, or that's associated with a bacteria that may be overgrowing in our GI tract, or you know, something other than that we're eating in our food. Besides gluten, there's a lot of different things that we'll talk about. So we have to have exposure to some sort of antigen that our immune system does not like, that it thinks is not us. And then we have to have a genetic characteristic as a unique individual that we take that antigen when we're exposed to it, and we more efficiently than maybe most people hold it out to our immune cells, saying that this is not me, this is something foreign, we need to fight this, and we need to activate an immune response against it. So we need the exposure, number one. We need the genetic characteristics, and we'll talk maybe about what are things called as HLA antigens. Some of us have certain patterns where we hold out one of these antigens very efficiently for the immune system to overreact to it. And then the final thing is we need to have some issues in our gastrointestinal tract, which lead to a phenomenon known as leaky gut or hyperpermeability that would allow these antigens to come through too quickly and to destabilize our immune system. And when we have all of those three things conspiring against us, we can actually have an immune system that goes out of whack and out of balance and starts attacking one or more of our tissues. It could be the thyroid, it could be the joints, it could be the brain, it could be a whole host of different tissues. But we've sort of set up a scenario with the way we eat as opposed to how we used to eat. The modern hygiene we'll talk about, we kind of, some people argue we live in too clean of an environment, which has changed our immune response, and the stress that we're under. So there are a lot of different things that are the perfect storm, like I say, in the modern sort of Western and classically the American existence that lays a sort of a soil, if you will, for autoimmune disease.
And I know that some of that research, or the idea of the three legs, comes from Fasano and his article on celiac in Scientific America. My understanding is there are actually even people with celiac disease getting diagnosed now that don't have the genes. I mean, that we are now even seeing a turn in the tide that people without some sort of genes towards autoimmunity are now getting autoimmune.
Yeah, that's true. And we don't know if it's because we don't understand that there's other genetic, you know, patterns that may be at play that we just have not identified yet, or if it's going around the genes. You know, we don't know, but we certainly know that the landscape and the environment which humans now live in the modern world is drastically different than it was for 99.9% of the time we've been on the planet as humanoids. We live in a false reality or a false world. I mean, when you look at our ancestors who were Paleolithic, you know, roaming hunter gatherers and eaters of opportunity, you know, we now eat the same foods that are all packaged and have all the same antigens in them, whether we know it or not. We have an overabundance of food. We live in sterile, fake, you know, things we called houses. That's not what we lived in before. We just live in a fake world for, you know, who we are from an evolutionary standpoint. So there's benefits to that. You know, we've done a lot of controlling infectious disease and other things with our modern hygiene, but we've destabilized our immune systems. There's no doubt about it. And there's some very specific ways that we know, or mechanisms by which that has occurred. One of the main ones is with foods of modern convenience that have much less fiber, much more sugar, and much less fermented type of foods, we've changed the bugs that live in our gut, the bacteria, the fungi, the parasites. We fundamentally changed this very complex ecosystem that's in this tube running through the middle of us, and we call that the GI microbiota. And now that we're able to use certain testing to be able to map the GI microbiota, we're starting to better understand what's quote-unquote normal or healthy and what's aberrant. And it's very clear that one of the things that really pops out or emerges in people with specific autoimmune diseases is they have a very predictable aberrant pattern of the bugs that grow in their gut. For instance, someone who has Hashimoto's thyroiditis or Graves' disease of the thyroid, these are autoimmune thyroiditises. Those patients have a very high prevalence of overgrowth of a certain bug in the gut called Yersinia, or Yersinia enterocolitica specifically. And why would that be? Well, we don't know why that individual might have a propensity to have this bacteria overgrow in their gut. There could be various reasons for that, dietary, stress, you know, their personal unique immune response. But if they do get an overgrowth in this bacteria, it expresses on its surface proteins that your immune system reacts to and tries to build, that's the antigen, it tries to build antibodies to kind of bind to this organism and neutralize it, if you will. And those antigens or proteins on this Yersinia bacteria are very similar in structure, not exact, but very similar to the TSH receptors on your thyroid that respond to the signaling hormone that tells your thyroid to put out more hormone. And if you get this overgrowth of bacteria in the gut, you build antibodies to bind to the Yersinia to control the infection. But when they're rolling by the thyroid in the bloodstream, they see the TSH receptor stuck on the thyroid. And they go, you know what, close enough, particularly if they're inflamed already and they have a somewhat imbalanced immune response. And it binds to your own thyroid and directs an basically an immune attack against your thyroid. So we call that molecular mimicry when you're exposed to one antigen. It could be a bacteria, it could be a virus, it could be something, a protein in the foods that you're eating that has a structure close enough to a protein that's on your own tissues normally. And your immune system, when it's inflamed and imbalanced, loses the ability to discriminate between the subtle differences. And you then, instead of just trying to neutralize and attack that bacteria or virus or food protein, attack whatever tissue that similar protein is on. In the case of the Yersinia, it's the thyroid. But we have overgrowth patterns we see in rheumatoid arthritis with bugs called Klebsiella and Citrobacter that it crosses over to the synovial joint linings. It's not only in the gut either. We know that people, for instance, with rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune inflammatory arthritis, they can have an overgrowth of a bacteria in the urinary tract called Proteus mirabilis, which can also trigger this autoimmune response. So it's not just bugs in the gut like bacteria. It could be viruses that you are exposed to that you never fully quite get rid of, and they become what we call stealth infections. It's a smoldering infection that you never really know. You don't have an obvious viral infection. I mean, maybe you're a little fatigued or something, but it's not like you have a cold or a flu kind of thing. But you have a virus that's sort of smoldering away and creating an immune response, which can cause crossover. We know viruses trigger type 1 diabetes, for instance. We know viruses can trigger multiple sclerosis. But viruses can also trigger cancer. So that's sort of a phenomenon of molecular mimicry as well. And then finally, food proteins. I mean, gluten and gliadin are the most well-known obvious ones. But I mentioned type 1 diabetes before. If you give a genetically susceptible child, and so not all children, just those with susceptible cow's milk when they're young, growing up, they will react immunologically to one of the bovine albumin peptides in cow's milk. And sooner or later, they will get enough aggressiveness against it and they will not be able to tell the subtle difference between that milk protein and the proteins on the islet cells in the pancreas that make insulin. And you very rapidly get a crossover reaction or a molecular mimicry action, which can destroy the insulin producing cells very rapidly. That's why, you know, a young, otherwise healthy individual can be perfectly fine one day, and the next day they fall over unconscious. They get taken to the emergency room, and their glucose is, you know, 400. It happens very quickly when the transition occurs. But it's definitely triggered by an environmental antigen in a person that's susceptible to it, and usually they have to have this hyperpermeability in the gut lining for all of this to conspire together, resulting in an autoimmune disorder.
Right. That was a really great overview. Oh, in, you know, my understanding is that it's, you know, 25 to 30% is genetics and 70 to 75% is our environment and all the things that you were just talking about.
Yeah, and you know, what I'm talking about is sort of the mechanisms that we understand and the triggers and the associations that we know and have established. But, you know, there's a lot more that we don't know about why and how this happens than we do know. So this is an evolving story.
Right. So along those lines, and talking about, we haven't really gotten into the gene hypothesis, but something that kind of came to my mind, do you use soil-based probiotics in your autoimmune patients?
We do at times. We use general probiotics a lot. We use some soil-based organisms occasionally. But, you know, I think the bigger message from this is we need to go back to letting our children kind of sample their environment while their immune system is developing. They need to, you know, we don't want them bathed in filth. And, you know, I mean, that's, you know, one of the benefits that we've cleaned up the environment so we don't have all these, you know, infectious disease outbreaks. But we also don't want them so afraid to get dirty or to be in the dirt or to sample their environment that they never learn to live in some harmony or tolerance. We call it, you know, an environmental or self-tolerance. So my kids, for instance, I have two young boys. I mean, they're out in the backyard. We have a stream running through our backyard. They're in the stream catching crayfish and frogs. I mean, they're in the lake. They come up to the back door, and I got to hose them off half the time to tell if they're my kids or not, to let them in the house. And I'm not worried about that. I think it's good that they sample their environment. I mean, so many kids today, first of all, they're not born through normal childbirth. And when the baby goes through the vaginal canal, they get seeded with all the right bacteria that from mom that starts their immune response and tolerance. And if you're born by cesarean section, for whatever reason, either electively or because medically it's warranted, you're at a disadvantage right away because you don't get that proper culturing, if you will, with the normal flora that you should develop in your GI tract and learn to live in harmony with. Then if you compound it that you don't get breastfed and you are formula fed, there's another problem because you don't get some of the seeding of the bacteria and the other exposures through breastfeeding, and you don't get some of the immunoglobulins that you need to have a stable immune system. So you grow up sort of against behind the eight ball right away. And then you're raised in this, you know, in a house with, you know, semi-sterile, you know, all the carpeting and draperies, off-gassing all kinds of toxins, but not full of the things, you know, that you're going to need to learn to live with. Eventually, you're going to be exposed to these environmental bacteria and viruses and things. And if you're bathed in antibacteria, triclosan-laden, you know, soap products five times a day and never let play in the dirt and all because mom's, you know, got a germ phobia, you're going to be one of these kids that's racked with allergies and asthma and reactive airway disease and all kinds of things. Because we know kids that grow up in urban or even suburban environments are full of these atopic disorders, you know, asthma and skin, you know, problems and reactive airway disease and hay fever and things like that. And for instance, kids who grow up in rural environments, like on farms where they come into contact early with animals, with, you know, livestock, they drink raw milk, they have these inherent exposures to their environment. They don't have any of those things. They don't have all these modern problems with asthma and reactive airway disease and hay fever and seasonal allergies. They have a fundamentally different immune system because they grow up as their immune system's developing in an environment that humans were much more accustomed to doing so than the modern suburban, urban kind of living.
Right. I always feel like if I, you know, thankfully I had was born vaginally, I was breastfed, you know, we played out in the yard. Thinking, my God, I would have gotten an autoimmune disease way, way earlier in life had I not done all of those things, you know.
And it doesn't mean if you know, you've had all those things in line for you that you can't develop an autoimmune disease.
Oh, yes, of course.
It's just a matter of, you know, your likelihood of developing one would be much less.
Yes. No, I mean, I have all the risk factors that we'll go through. I don't think you mentioned heavy metals in this paper, but
various toxins can heavy metals are really bad because the heavy metals have a tendency, they're transitional metals if you know anything about chemistry, so they have an inherent ability to kind of latch onto our own body proteins. They latch onto this sulfur group hanging on our proteins, and now it's not just your normal protein, it's the protein plus the heavy metal. And when we have that combination, it's called a haptin. And your immune system looks at that as a foreign protein, just like it would a bacteria or a virus or some food it didn't like. So the heavy metals can be very immunologically sabotaging, if you will, particularly mercury and lead and some of the ones that we're commonly exposed to.
Right. So kind of back to the infections, can we kind of walk through, are those typically things that, you know, are going to get picked up on a regular urine test for someone with rheumatoid arthritis? And if so, why are not more doctors picking it up? Are these things, you know, most found in a traditional stool test or just sort of the comprehensive ones that you and I use? Can kind of walk through where somebody might pick up these or detect these infections or ask their regular doctor or functional medicine doctor or alternative doctor to order for them?
Well, part of the title of that paper that you read was, you know, listed all these things, molecular mimicry, hygiene hypothesis, and all that. And other examples of disconnect between the medical research and clinical practice. What I was trying to say is these connections, these associations, and even now we know there's causal data that these things actually are not just associated with autoimmune disease, they're causal to it, is well established in the medical literature. And it's not brand new. I mean, we're understanding it more and more, but I mean, these concepts go back a couple of decades. I think in my presentation this morning, I showed something out of the Journal of Rheumatology from 1990 talking about these aberrant gastrointestinal bacterial patterns and rheumatoid arthritis. And, you know, and I asked the audience, how many of you have had patients who have rheumatoid arthritis that go to a rheumatologist? Have they ever had a stool analysis done to look at what kind of bugs are growing in their gut? And basically no one does. It's not on the radar of conventional or orthodox physicians. They're just not trained to look at these associations and to proactively deal with these things before the disease ultimately manifests itself. They basically wait until you have the clinical symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or Hashimoto's or what have you, and then they treat symptomatically. So in rheumatoid arthritis, they're going to give you anti-inflammatory agents of some sort and then even immune response modulators, you know, things that suppress the immune response and chemotherapeutic agents. I mean, really heavy, you know, things to deal with the symptoms, and they can help you feel better, but they actually drive the disease process worse. And the side effects are things like leukemia and lymphoma and, you know, nothing good. But they don't fundamentally put these associations and things we know from the literature into play in clinical practice. I hope someday that will change, but right now, if you go to your standard physician, even your specialist, like a rheumatologist, let's say, or an immunologist, and you talk to him about this molecular mimicry, and can you check my stool for this or that, or my urinary tract to see if I have Proteus, they won't do it. It's not on their radar, number one. And then the test, you know, a standard stool analysis that you'd get done by your family practitioner or even a gastroenterologist, is really a very, very small panel looking just for usually a couple parasites and a few organisms that are known to cause, you know, obvious frank diarrhea. They're not mapping the entire GI microbiota looking for these organisms that we know are associated with autoimmune disease. So sort of the functional medicine, integrative medicine doctor who will do a complete digestive stool analysis would be more looking at those types of things. And if you do a urinalysis culture, or if you do a urinalysis and a culture, they're looking for the obvious organisms that cause sort of in-your-face classic urinary tract infections. They're not looking for these lower-level stealth infections of organisms like Proteus mirabilis in the urinary tract. So you will come up with a normal urinalysis and culture even if you have stealth Proteus infection, which is the underlying thing for causing your RA. The research groups such as Alan Emberger in the UK and other groups that have made these associations have developed more sensitive specific lab assays to look for these things in people. They're not available commercially right now because there's not enough doctors who understand this enough to order them enough for to be economically viable for the lab to even offer the test, unfortunately.
So are you, if you're hitting a road, I mean, do you empirically put people on these antibiotics for these infections that you know are associated with these diseases, or do you sort of go through our typical functional medicine protocol, and then if they're hitting a roadblock and not getting better with, you know, our standard elimination diet, healing the gut, you know, dealing with toxins and, you know, other more obvious infections, then you do that, or what's kind of your approach?
Generally, it's the latter. But if I have someone who has a very strong, they're seropositive for rheumatoid arthritis, they have a strong family history of it and things like that, we will sometimes put them on an antibiotic like Cipro for the assuming they have stealth proteus infection, and we see how they respond. If we don't do that, I at least use agents that are effective at blocking these organisms that can be present in the urinary tract, blocking them from adhering to the bladder walls and the ureter walls. We use things like N-acetylglucosamine and D-mannose. For instance, you know, even in run-of-the-mill urinary tract infections, a lot of women will use cranberry juice therapy. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, cranberry has a lot of D-mannose, which is a sugar that blocks or covers the receptor sites on E. coli and other organisms that are common to cause UTIs, and does not allow them to basically bind to your tissues, and you flush them out if you drink lots of fluids or, you know, take some sort of diuretic type of foods, which we have people do. And that can be helpful as well. So there's various ways to kind of go at it. But, you know, what's interesting in the functional medicine approach to autoimmune disease is, in the end, it really doesn't matter to us what the label is. It doesn't matter whether it's rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis or lupus or Hashimoto's. We go after the same foundational things, which really go back to the three-legged stool, right? We want to see, well, what are possible environmental exposures that this patient is being exposed to? And if we know that they have X autoimmune disease like Hashimoto's, then we're going to look for known associations to Hashimoto's, like the Yersinia overgrowing in the, or the, you know, are they, do they have gluten gliadin sensitivity? Are they eating, the field grass grains, you know, your wheats and rye and barley? Because, for instance, if you go to the extreme with someone, for instance, who has celiac disease, we know they have 20 times the rate of Hashimoto's and Graves. 20 times the rate. Plus, they have a much higher likelihood of early onset dementia and degenerative neurological conditions. So even if, you know, we'll test things, we'll use immunological food compatibility testing. There's various types of ways to do that, but we'll test those things. And if there's any even sniff of there being, you know, sensitivity, we'll pull it out of the diet. And honestly, in patients who have autoimmune thyroid disorder or even a history of it strongly in their family, and it usually runs in the women in the family much more commonly than men, we'll pull gluten, gliadin-containing grains right out of their diet, and we'll do a comprehensive stool analysis looking for Yersinia and any other opportunistic organisms, and then we'll do our best to try to rebuild a optimal GI microbiota. So we're giving them things like probiotics. We're using often botanical or volatile oil, sort of natural antimicrobials to nudge out these opportunistic or the wrong bugs. And then we'll do things to really heal up, tighten up, and really make as healthy as possible the lining of the gut so there's no leaky gut or hyperpermeability. And at the same time, you know, we're just really trying to clean up their diet, less inflammatory, reduce their stress, because cortisol and other stress hormones are known to sabotage the immune response at the level of the GI lining called mucosal immunity and cause leaky gut. So we're attacking, in autoimmune disease, we're kind of going after the same foundational elements, even though we might get a little bit specific in what trigger organism or trigger food that we're looking at based on what tissue they're fundamentally attacking.
Yes.
I don't know if that made any sense. It was a long response.
It definitely made sense to me. I think hopefully it'll make sense to the listeners because they're used to hearing us talk or hearing me talk about this very frequently about the leaky gut and that how exactly, I mean, it's so interesting with autoimmune diseases as opposed to, you know, most cancers, you go to the oncologist, but with autoimmune diseases, you go to the rheumatologist. Right. If it's, you know, joint, if it's rheumatoid arthritis, but you're going to the endocrinologist, if it's your thyroid, I mean, they're all these, the GI doctor, if it's celiac.
Right. So, and the neurologist, if it's dementia.
Right. Right. So you're going to all these different, and what I try to tell people is, no, it's your immune system. You have a problem with your immune system. It doesn't really matter which tissue it ultimately attacked or what name they gave you. The problem's in the immune system, and we have to fix the immune system.
Yeah. Plus, you know, the data is pretty clear showing that it's more than just your one diagnosis, because, you know, let's say you get diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and usually people are diagnosed in the hypothyroid state after enough thyroid tissue has been destroyed. They're hypothyroid, they're put on hormone replacement therapy, whatever, and they just sort of, okay, then now you're fine, your thyroid levels are good. But it still doesn't do anything to address the fundamentally imbalanced immune response. And it's clear, there's an adage now in autoimmune disease, which is get one, get another. So it's only a matter of time before you start attacking another tissue.
Absolutely. That is what I have in my book. You know, we're talking about exactly that exact thing. You think, oh, no big deal. I just got put on some thyroid medicine, pretty innocuous, no real side effects if they get you on the right dose, move on with your life. But if they don't treat the underlying cause of why your immune system went awry and started attacking you, you're three times more likely to get something else. And next time you may not be as lucky. It might be lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or MS. And so, I tell people these things in my office and they're just looking at me and I'm like, you don't want to have that gluten. You do not, it's your birthday. You want a gluten-free cake. Better if you have, a grain-free cake or just don't have the cake at all. But if you can't do that, at least the gluten-free one, because, and I don't know if you feel the same way, but I pretty much assume if you have an autoimmune disease, you have a gluten issue. I don't really care what any sort of antibody test tells me, just in my sort of experience clinically and what I know, the likelihood is that you have a gluten issue.
Well, you definitely have one until proven otherwise. The problem is we don't have a good way to prove otherwise. So I agree with you. And, and gluten and gliadin and the problems with things like wheat and all even go beyond just the autoimmunity issue. It's the addictive properties of the glutamorphogens and, right on down the line. And, if you read, there's great books out, whether it's Bill Davis's book on wheat belly or David Perlmutter's book on grain brain. I mean, they're all, really bringing incredible information to the fore on why these things are problematic. And we were just never as a species meant to eat those field grass grains. They're for ruminants. Animals that are designed to eat it can break it down. As humans, we generally cannot. We don't have the enzymes to break down some of those complexes and they cause immunogenic havoc in the body. Now, clearly some people can get away with them more than others, but generally, we're just, as a species, not meant to eat that stuff.
And it's kind of interesting to me because I feel like you and I and maybe, David Perlmutter are kind of the ones that really feel that way within our little, tribe or group. I mean, I definitely feel like even within functional medicine, you're kind of learning gluten's bad, but, you can still do the rices and you can still do a lot of these other grains. And so it's kind of, I feel like sometimes I'm straddling this world between functional medicine and paleo, really feel like.
No, it is. And there are a lot of people that kind of think, well, we understand that gluten and gliadin is a problem for some people, but it's sort of the fad, Like it's the latest thing. And there may be elements of that are going on, but by and large, I think, you go back to the work of Lauren Cordain and all, you just mentioned Paleolithic and, the evidence is clear. I mean, humans just are not very compatible with those field grass grains. Now, I will concede that, the commercial farming and modern agriculture, and by modern, I don't mean the 20th century, I mean just in the last couple thousand years, that's a big source of caloric intake for a lot of the planet, and it's allowed us to sustain a much larger population than we would be able to if we were all strictly paleolithically eating. But there's a price to pay for it, and we're with this perfect storm now in the last 50 years or so, with all the sort of over hygiene, if you will, and now the processed packaged foods, not eating a varied diet, because we no longer have seasonal variation in our diet because we import foods from all over. We don't have, we don't eat locally. I mean, there's just so many things conspiring that has just tipped it over. We've reached a tipping point that our immune system could just no longer cope.
Absolutely. So I have to just share my quick story sort of on the Paleolithic topic that we were on. My father has autoimmune. He has polymyositis, so his muscles are breaking down to the point that he's almost, definitely walker bound, if not almost wheelchair bound, and was needing to have a hip replacement. And he had tried, obviously, I'm his daughter, you know, we've had multiple conversations. He had tried gluten-free and really didn't notice anything. So I could tell he was getting very nervous about the surgery. I was very nervous about the surgery. He was on prednisone, Cellcept, and methotrexate, and 76 years old and, you know, autoimmune and going in for a hip replacement. I mean, I was terrified. I could tell he was. So it was over the holidays and we started having the conversation about paleo, or what actually I call the Myers way, but an autoimmune version, which is very similar to paleo, but probably has more leafy greens and stuff in it. And so I convinced him, you know, he was going to do this thing. I said, why don't you do it before your surgery and just get as healthy as you can in the next 30 days. So he does it. Thankfully, my stepmother, who is a vegetarian for 35 years, actually adopted a paleo lifestyle with him in order to support him. And so they do that. He goes off, has his surgery. And I said, well, Dad, while you're there, oh, they have to get him off his Cellcept in order to do the surgery. So he's been off the Cellcept for a month. He goes in for the surgery. And I said, well, Dad, have him check a CPK number for you while you're there, which for those listening, that's one of the markers to check for muscle breakdown and what is typically elevated for him. So his doctor does not want to do it. I mean, he's thinking the guy's off Cellcept. He's just had a surgery. We are not checking this thing right now. And I just said, Dad, come on, just please ask him if they'll do it for you. So they check his CPK number, and his CPK number was lower than it has ever been. And he had just had a surgery and was off one of his major, major immunosuppressive meds. So he's now convinced. He's lost 20 pounds. He's awesome. Feeling great and has not gotten back on the Cellcept. And we're working towards getting him off, you know, the rest of his medication. So it, you know, and that is literally the only thing he, I mean, of course, all along he's been taking some high quality supplements from me and some other things. But really, that to me is the true power of diet and all of this. I mean, the infections, the leaky gut, I mean, all of this stuff. But as you and I know, what we eat influences the gut and the microbiota in the gut, and then, you know, influences whether you have leaky gut or not. But really, in 30 days, you can change your life by, you know, following many of the things that you're talking about, that I talk about. I'm sure that you work with your patients on, you know, getting off these foods, healing the gut, and then, yeah, looking for the infections and toxins and the stress. And boom, it's like, it is that simple. So hopefully that little story gave some people some, you know, encouragement out there that are suffering with autoimmunity.
Well, I really think, you know, one of the final things I wanted to drive home is we have some really incredible predictive tests now called predictive autoantibodies that can be done on people, particularly if they have they don't have autoimmune disease yet. It's not been diagnosed yet, but they have family members that have autoimmunity in particular. We can, in a very proactive way, do some basic blood tests that have what are known as predictive autoantibodies. And if you're coming up with those, we know that these things emerge in the blood 7 to 10, even 15 years before you would ever diagnose a certain autoimmune disease by clinical symptoms. So if you find those autoantibodies, that is really powerful information to share with the patient and to start taking very proactive strategies to stop this train from rolling down the track. Because if you don't stop it, it's going to get to an autoimmune disease. And right now, we're waiting to diagnose it when it's the horse has kind of left the barn, you know, and then we're just left with symptom mediating agents. And then, you know, if someone emerges with full blown rheumatoid arthritis or Hashimoto's, and then, you know, you put them on a gluten free diet and they're like, hey, well, I have no huge difference. Well, you intervene so late, you know, it can be helpful then. But can you imagine how helpful it would be as if, you know, if you had a different strategy where we use these predictive autoantibody tests proactively, prophylactically, if you will, and if they were positive, then you got them on a gluten-free diet, you cleaned up the gut, you know, environment, you tightened up their gut lining, you got them on a good, healthy lifestyle, lower stress. Well, guess what? Then 10, 15 years later, they never developed that autoimmune disease.
I tell people that, you know, when I hear the story of the woman coming in and, you know, her mom, her grandmother had Hashimoto's, her mom has Hashimoto's, her aunt had Hashimoto's, she's in my office getting diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and I start talking to her about her unborn child. And I'm like, how many doctors are you going to go to? They're actually going to talk to you about your unborn child. I'm like, look, if you have a girl, you know, you can already see what is going to happen here. So let's, you know, these are the strategies to take for this unborn child, you know, so they're never in your shoes or your mother's shoes or your grandmother's shoes. So completely agree with you on that. One final question that I have for you is, you know, the paper that kind of was going around, I think it was a couple months back, just about salt and autoimmune and stimulating Th17.
Right.
What, I mean, is that really salt, like as in, you know, sea salt, or is that really from packaged foods and the really...
Well, I think the literature and the main study on that came out of right up the road from me at Yale. The researchers at Yale just looked at sodium chloride content in the diet and levels of autoimmunity. And you're right, it activates the immune cells to spill out Th17, which can induce autoimmunity. It's sodium chloride, no matter what the source. So I think... You know, it's like anything else. It's dose dependent, right? I mean, salt is absolutely, we have to have sodium chloride, but with all the prepackaged foods of convenience, the fast foods and all that, all of this is just so packed with sodium chloride that I think our overall consumption of it, not you and I, not people who maybe come to see us who are very healthy in their diet, but when you span this across the population, you know, the standard American diet eating population, they're gobbling up a lot more salt than they're meant to.
Yeah, I just didn't know if I really need to be concerned about getting people off of sea salt as well, you know, or if that's...
I don't think so.
I wouldn't think so either. Yeah.
Unless your total intake is excessive, you know.
And what do you think about potassium? I mean, do you think it's an imbalance in the sodium-potassium ratio and adding potassium, or that it's...
I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, they didn't really address that in that study.
I ask people who are smarter than me like you these questions.
I don't know about that.
That's why I love being part of the journal club with you guys.
Yeah. Well, you see how far that got you.
No, I'm like, whenever I see Patrick Hanaway, who's now the director of education for functional medicine, he's like, I always love talking to you because you ask these questions like nobody else asks. I'm like, I know, but half the time nobody can answer them. But I try to hang around you guys that are much smarter than me so I can at least, you know, see what y'all are thinking about it.
Right. Well, I don't have an answer for you on that one. I wish I did, but it's an interesting study to do. That's for sure.
Yes. Well, I so enjoyed this topic. I think it's going to be a big hit because, you know, of all the number of people with autoimmune, I know whenever I write an article about autoimmune, it's a big hit on the blog. So I think that hopefully you will, you know, see a lot of traffic to your site from this. I encourage everybody to go there. So tell us how you are a practicing physician. So if people want to make an appointment with you, go to your website, get more information.
Yeah, I practice I'm in a group integrative medicine practice in Trumbull, Connecticut, which is near Fairfield. It's, you know, about an hour and 15 minutes outside of, up the coast and out of Manhattan, 2 hours from Boston. So I have patients from all over the world and certainly all over the country. But if anyone wants to know more, they can just go to drdavidbrady.com. That's drdavidbrady.com. And there's information on my private practice as well.
Great. Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate you being on the call.
Thanks, Amy. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at Amy Myers, MD.